You know how sometimes we move the amendment and vote on it before?
Okay. Well, and please jump in on that, because I mean, I'm fine with doing that.
Are you feeling better?
Council will come back to order. Carla, would you please call the roll?
Saltzman?
Here.
Leonard?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Adams? Fish?
Here. Well, welcome back, everybody. And Carla, would you please read the 3 o'clock time certain?
Item 560, improve land regulations and procedures related to schools as part of the Schools and Parks Conditional Use Code Refinement Project. Did you want 561 as well?
Please.
561, improve land use regulations and procedures related to recreational fields as part of the Schools and Parks Conditional Use Code Refinement Project.
Thank you. For those of you who are new to the hearing today, I am not Sam Adams. Mayor Adams is homesick and sends his regrets that he could not be here. As the president of the council, I'll chair the hearing, and we have quite a lot of invited testimony, and then I understand a number of people have signed up. So we're going to start with a presentation on what's before us, and Deborah, would you lead us off?
I will. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Deborah Stein with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and I'm joined today by my colleagues Brett Horner from the Bureau of Parks and Recreation, and Douglas Hardy from the Bureau of Development Services, and also Sean Woods from Bureau of Planning and Sustainability is sitting here with me. And we are here today to present to you Planning Commission's recommendation on the Schools and Parks Conditional Use Code Refinement Project. I'm going to give you a brief overview of the project, including a little bit of context and background of what prompted us to take this on, and give you a summary of some of the highlights that are in the code package before you. And the actual code amendments are in this blue document, which I think you all have. I'll be touching on some of the highlights of those code amendments related to schools and then also related to recreational fields. And these code amendments before you today would be housed in both Title 33, which is the city zoning code, as well as Title 20, which is the city's parks and recreation code. Following my presentation, we're pleased to have 3 planning commissioners here today to talk about the thinking behind the recommendation you'll be hearing, and then we'll open up to public testimony and then your deliberations and decision.
Thank you.
This project encompasses 4 topic areas, and there's a fundamental question that is common to all 4 of these situations, and that question is, what is the right set of thresholds to trigger a conditional use review for the following situations? So the questions are, when there are enrollment changes in a school, what should be the threshold to trigger that review? If there are changes of grade levels within a school, what are the right thresholds to trigger that review? When there are changes of activity or levels of intensity on a recreational field, again, what's the right set of thresholds for that review? And the 4th question that's covered is, when a school use leaves a school and the school site is vacant, what's the proper amount of time to allow that school to be vacant before we need to initiate a new conditional use review to reestablish that school use? How long should it be vacant? So those are the 4 questions that are encompassed in this project. And because I kept referring to conditional use review, I just want to take a minute to explain what that is. A conditional use is a type of use that's allowed in the zoning code only after reviewing that potential use for any potential impacts that that use may impose on the surrounding neighborhood. And those are physical impacts, things like traffic, noise, litter, and so forth. So the use may not necessarily cause those impacts, but we need to go through a review process to ascertain whether there would be impacts. And if so, the use would be allowed only after there are mitigation measures applied to the approval to make sure that those impacts are reduced. There are two different types of conditional use review processes, and that's another one of the questions that we'll be covering in this recommendation before you today. It's not just what's the threshold to trigger the review, but if that review is triggered, what type of review? And there are 2 types of conditional use processes. The first is called a Type 2, and that takes about 8 weeks of processing time, costs $3,600 to go through that review. The second type of a conditional use review is a type 3, and that has a 15-week time frame and is significantly more expensive. It's $11,000 to $16,000. But importantly, both of these reviews use the same criteria to make the analysis, to do the analysis of what the impacts are. So the evaluation is the same, but the processing time is different and the cost is different. The other difference between these two types of reviews is who's the decision maker and to whom the decision can be appealed. In the case of a type 2, the decision maker is staff with an appeal to hearings officer. In the case of the type 3, the hearings officer is the decision maker, and that can be appealed to City Council. So I want to talk for a couple minutes about what prompted us to take this project on. What were the factors that then initiated this? The problem that we were responding to was really based on some community concerns we had about both field improvements and school reconfigurations. In the case of the field improvements, what prompted us to take a look at our code was a situation at Fernwood Middle School, what's now Beverly Cleary, but at the time was Fernwood Middle School, where the Little League made some improvements to the field to accommodate Little League use. And I think what we learned from that experience was that there were a lot of things that didn't go well with that process. I think it was a situation that didn't work well for the neighbors, didn't work well for Development Services, Parks and Recreation, so forth. So we wanted to all learn from that experience and say, what didn't go well in terms of the review process, notification, operationally, that we could learn from to revise some of our processes to better address the kinds of things we learned. So it was actually a very educational case study for us. The second thing that prompted this project was that there were a number of code compliance violation cases filed by the public in response to a number of schools that had been reconfigured by Portland Public Schools when they made some changes between schools that had previously been K through 5 were converted to K through 8. There were some 6 through 8 schools that added lower grades. So there were a number of changes to grades, and as a result of those, the city received 102 code compliance complaints that we were asked to process. And what we learned from that experience is that Bureau of Development Services found that the code was not entirely clear because of some different definitions and how things were termed, so that they put those enforcement complaints on hold until we could clarify and understand the code better. So those code compliance cases are on hold today, awaiting the resolution of these code issues by your decision today. In the process of looking at all of those, we also found there were a few other things in our code that, while weren't related to any of the code compliance issues, also revealed some code ambiguity and some things that just weren't clear that also related to schools and parks. So we decided to bundle that together as part of this one project. The other thing we learned, though, in the course of initiating this project and talking to the public, that while we identified a number of code issues, there were also a significant number of very important, larger policy issues related to schools that came to our attention and were very important to address. These are issues related to socioeconomic implications of school decisions, issues of equity, opportunity, and so forth. So we decided that it was really appropriate to take this on as a three-pronged approach. So what you're hearing today and what we're going to be focusing on today is only the first prong of that approach, and that's looking at the code amendments, clarifications, thresholds, and so forth. But we also want to be mindful of the two other approaches which are part of this overall effort. And the second approach would be looking at policy changes. This would be through the Portland Plan conversations that are going on now and continuing on through the update of the comprehensive plan. And that's where we really can get into the meatier policy issues regarding equity, socioeconomic implications, the role of schools in community, schools as centers of community. There are a lot of big policy issues we want to tackle, and those would be the places to do that. And then the third approach, third prong of the approach, would be through intergovernmental agreements. And we would like to pursue a path where we have a way to outline a process through which our school districts and city government can identify how and when to consult with each other on issues of mutual importance, mutual concern, mutual interest. So we'd like to pursue that through some discussions about intergovernmental agreements as well. So this represents our more comprehensive, holistic approach to dealing with some of these schools' issues. I'm going to just grab water for a second. So I'm going to touch now on some of the highlights of those four topic areas that I outlined. I'm going to start with the three school-related issues and then finish with the recreational fields. The first topic area is the question about enrollment fluctuations. Currently, our code says that when a school changes its enrollment, that triggers a conditional use review. And practically, that's a very difficult thing to implement. Functionally, a lot of schools change enrollment literally daily. There's a lot of change. So what we wanted to do was find a way to appropriately address the issue of school expansion, but not by counting the number of students, and instead build in some flexibility that allows some fluctuation in enrollment, but uses a better proxy for intensity and increasing the use of the school site. So we're looking to a square footage limit as the way to trigger or a threshold to trigger a conditional use review. And what we have in our code today is a 1,500 square foot addition. If you add 1,500 square feet of additional floor area, that triggers a conditional use review. And we think that's an appropriate way to catch any expansion and review it for any impacts on the neighborhood. I want to point out that 1,500 square feet threshold is a useful threshold because all of the portables that you've seen installed in certain schools over time, those are always about 1,800 square feet. So those would all have to undergo a conditional use review when a portable is added to a campus.
And that's current code?
It's current code, and we want to continue to use that as the proxy. But yes, that's current code. The second topic area, and this was the subject of all of the code compliance cases that were filed, is the change of grade level. When should that trigger a conditional use review? And when it does trigger that review, what's the appropriate level of review? Currently, the code talks about grade levels. It talks about elementary school and middle school or junior high school. And it doesn't refer to the actual grades. So one of the things we want to do is change that so we refer to the grades themselves, 6, 7, 8, for example, as opposed to a category that is a looser definition. We have a number of pieces of this recommendation that I will illustrate with the following slides to show what we're proposing in terms of what triggers the review and what type of review. So the first scenario I want to show is when you start with a school that currently has grades 6 through 8, typically known as a middle school. That's our starting point here. And if you were to add grades K through 5, any grades K through 5, to that school, we're proposing that that be a Type 3 conditional use review. If you instead you start with that grade 6 through 8 school and you were to add older students, grades 9 through 12, or any or all of those grades, that also, in our proposal, would be a Type 3 conditional use. And the next scenario is we start with an elementary school, grades K through 5. And if you were to add grades 6 through to 8 to that K through 5 school, we're proposing that that be done by right without a conditional use. And that's current code, right? That's retaining the current code. And the last example I want to provide here is if you start...
And I'm sorry, was that a Type 3 or Type 2 in the current code?
It's without... There's no review required for
no
that.
Review.
That's the one grade change that doesn't trigger a use review, and we would propose still to let that be allowed.
Thank you.
And then the last example is if you start with a high school, grades 9 through 12, and you were to add the younger grades, 6 through 8, we're proposing that that be a Type 2 conditional use.
So that I understand, if you take an existing high school building and convert it to K through 8 from 9 through 12, that would trigger conditional use.
Yes, if you have the 9 through 12 there, and you were to add the younger grades, not if you do
add them, I see.
You add them. So you're adding additional grade levels to what's already there, as opposed to a full conversion.
And that's not existing code, but proposed code.
The last example, I'm sorry, the. Adding the 6 to 8 to the 9 to 12, that there's no change. We're proposing to continue what the code says today.
Thank you.
So I'm going to skip to topic 4, which is also related to schools, and that's the conditional use status for vacant school property. So this is where a school, if a school were to leave a site, the site is vacant, and then a school wanted to reestablish a school, if the district wanted to reestablish a school in the vacant building, at what point would they have to go through a new review to reinitiate that use? Currently, the code says after 3 years, the site loses its status, and you'd have to go through a new review. And that has proved to be a little inflexible because it sometimes takes a little bit more time to reestablish a school in a building. So we're proposing to extend that vacant period to 5 years, and that would be a Type 2 review to reestablish after 5 years. If the school site were vacant for 10 years or more, then it would trigger a Type 3 review, which would be a much more significant review given the length of time it's been vacant. And I forgot to mention at the beginning that all of the things I'm mentioning regarding schools would apply to all of our school districts. We have 6 school districts that have school facilities in the city of Portland, and also private schools as well.
Deborah, I just have a question on that.
Sure.
If after 5 years of vacancy, the proposal would trigger a Type 2 review beyond 5 years if the district sought to activate the school again,
mm-hmm.
why is that? That is a lower threshold than the Type 3 that is suggested under change of grade. And I'm trying to understand why in a change of grade when there is there would be a Type 3, but a Type 2 after a five-year period for a vacant building. What was the thinking of the commission as to that distinction?
I don't know that they compared those two. I know the thinking with the Type 3 for either adding the high school students to a middle school or adding younger students to a middle school, those were two different rationales. I believe the rationale for adding for a Type 3 for adding the younger kids to the middle school was because of the transportation conflicts with younger kids, entering an environment that was really designed and is operating with older kids in mind. So that was a Type 3 because of those safety impacts that wanted that extra review. And I think that currently, and we're proposing to continue, that if you were adding high school students to a lower grade school, that introduces new impacts because high school students may drive, they can go off campus for lunch. There are a lot of things that older students may do that may introduce some impacts to the neighborhood. Now, I think that's the rationale for the Type 3 in both of those situations. I don't know that they compared that with the vacancy and reestablishing a school to say, are they commensurate?
Thank you.
So I'm going to go to the last topic area, which is recreational fields. And this is a topic that has a lot of issues embedded in the topic. The first was that currently, and the following things are all things we've noticed with our current code, schools and park sites are sometimes handled differently in the code than park sites, even though to a neighbor, it's a recreational field. There shouldn't necessarily be any distinction between who's operating or who's the permitting agency for the field. So we wanted to bring some consistency. So recreational fields, whether it's run by the school, run by the park bureau, that they're managed the same way with the same rules. The second, that currently the code measures intensity based on a counting of spectators. And if there's an increase in the number of spectators, that's the way that currently we say we're measuring an increase in intensity. And that has proven to be a very impractical measure. It's impossible or nearly impossible to count spectators, to have a baseline, to know how to keep records of that. It's just not a very practical way to measure intensity. So we were looking for other ways to serve as that sort of proxy to measure that intensity and increase. The other feature of the current code is that currently, if you convert or change the activity level from some younger kids to older kids or from youth to adult, there may be a change in some of the impacts associated with that level of activity, but neighbors are not notified of those changes. And that was one of the things that occurred in the Fernwood case, where we went from very young children playing t-ball to suddenly having Little League where the balls were hit harder and maybe travel farther and maybe more foul balls. So there were different kinds of impacts associated with a change in age level, but our current code didn't have a way to notify the neighbors of that change. And finally, our current code requires a full Type 3 review for a vast array of activities, and we found that maybe some of those weren't necessarily commensurate with the level of review. And I want to show you a few examples of that. There are the images. So you see the slide on the left, there's a relatively small bleacher. That goes through the same rigor of a review as the bleachers on the right currently. They both would go through a Type 3 review. Similarly, the two parking spaces on the left undergo the same Type 3 conditional use review as the large parking lot on the right. So our recommendation before you today is to do a few things. One is to retain a Type 3 conditional use review for those things that have potentially large impacts, the things that really deserve that very rigorous review with the public involvement associated with the Type 3. But for some other smaller types of development, we're proposing instead that those be a Type 2. We also are proposing to provide a process for public notification for things that may not trigger a conditional use review, but still deserve some upfront consultation between all of the players to make sure that we can address any concerns from neighbors upfront before it goes through and is built. So it provides for some early consultation, and there's also an option built in for a good neighbor agreement. In our proposal today, we're also proposing to clarify some vague code language that was in various places in both of the codes, Title 33 and Title 20. And finally, we have identified some very definable and measurable thresholds for review and for notification.
So if we could, before you move on,
yeah,
go back to that last slide.
Sure.
So you've taken some projects that currently are smaller projects but fall under Type 3 reviews and are recommending they be Type 2.
Correct.
And then you're taking and applying Type 3 reviews for developments of projects with potentially large impacts. Are those currently projects that are not required to have Type 3 reviews?
I would have to turn to Brett for that.
I would say that...
You could introduce yourself first.
I'm sorry, Douglas Hardy with Bureau of Development Services. Typically, for what's in the proposed code, those things that require Type 3 today would require Type 3. So, for example, if you were to add new lighting to a stadium, lighting to a field, if you were to add new seating to a field, parking, that type of thing, today would trigger Type 3, and under the proposed code would trigger a Type 3.
So basically what you're accomplishing here is removing from Type 3 review those smaller projects that you illustrated in the
right
pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And just to clarify that, the area which would not be subject to conditional use would be things like just replacing a field, for example.
Replacing an existing field.
If you change the surface or something of an existing field, that would not go through conditional use. Okay.
Does this apply to colleges?
Yeah, that question came up to us in the hallway.
Douglas Hardy again. It does not. The new chapter that was created for the rec fields for organized sports applies only to limited circumstances, so it applies to school sites, park sites, and I think there's one other type of circumstance. But otherwise, for institutions like colleges, universities, they would continue to be regulated by another part of the code, the 33.815 or 820, that deals with all other conditional uses.
Okay, and then thank you. My second question is, the current code regulates as conditional uses fields used for organized sports and other facilities that draw spectators to events in a park. The new code changes that to only recreational fields for organized sports. So what about adding a running track that's not a recreational field for organized sports?
Yeah, and
that would no longer be regulated.
I think that the response to that is that if there are spectators, and without, then what would be triggered would be the installation of the bleachers, because that would then indicate there'd be spectators, and it would be the spectators that would be bringing the impacts potentially. So if it were just a running track that doesn't attract any spectators, I'm not sure that it would trigger it would be a threshold that would trigger the review. But the spectators, that would be manifested through the installation of the bleachers, and that would trigger the review.
Yeah, and I think to add to that, in the existing code, it does focus, at least for open space, it does focus on fields that attract spectators to parks, It does, as you indicated, identify and other facilities that attract spectators. I think the thought may have been that certainly fields, baseball fields, football fields, soccer fields, are the ones that attract most spectators to the parks. The other recreational and facilities other than fields, yes, they may attract some spectators to the park, but it's a question of do they attract enough spectators that it merits a conditional use review.
What about a big skate park like in Gabor Park or Glendevere?
And I guess my response to that would be typically a skateboard park doesn't attract spectators. I mean, it's not an organized, sort of an organized sport that attracts spectators. And currently that's at least what the existing code is focusing on.
But wouldn't we want to look at, have a conditional use for the installation of a large skate park?
Well, even under today's code, that wouldn't trigger any sort of conditional use because, again, it's not for organized sports and it's not a facility. It would be, interpreted as a facility that doesn't attract spectators to the park. It may attract users to that facility, but not really spectators.
So what development standard would a skate park, skateboarding facility be subject to?
Under today's code?
Yeah.
It would just be, again, the use would be allowed. It would be the basic development standards, in that case, primarily the minimum setbacks from property lines.
Thank you.
So I wanted to give you just a couple of examples of some of the kinds of development that may require conditional use depending on what threshold is met. Field lighting, voice amplification, PA system, bleachers, as I had mentioned before, parking, the addition of new fields to an existing active recreational area, and concession areas. These are all things that, depending on size and threshold and so forth, may continue to trigger a conditional use review. So what we're proposing to you today is that you adopt Planning Commission's recommendation, and this includes the package that's contained in the blue document, plus two memoranda that you have, some minor amendments that were submitted to you on April 6th and again today with some sort of cleanup code language. These code amendments, again, are contained in both Title 33 and some of them in Title 20. And in addition to adopting these documents, we'd also like you to endorse a path forward through which we address some of the policy issues regarding the interplay between schools and community and some of the issues of equity and so forth related to schools. We'd like to follow a path where we do that through agreements between the school districts and city council, respecting and recognizing the individual decision-making jurisdiction that each body has, but also recognizing the importance of consultation and collaboration as we move forward. And secondly, through policy changes that would be considered through both the Portland plan and the following comprehensive plan update.
Deborah, I've been thrown into this role late in the game, so I want to make sure I understand what your guidance is to us. There are exhibits to our packets with some amendments that you're proposing, and these are not substantive changes. These are simply cleaning up the language.
These were, I believe, at the suggestion of the city attorney to just clarify some code language. I don't think that they're substantive in any way. And the April 6th memo we did provide to people on our mailing list, our interested party list, and put it on our website in this last amendment is just available today, but we have confidence that it's fairly minor.
So I'm not sure that I have those amendments if you have copies.
Okay, we have those.
May I ask a question?
Please, I have the amendments in. I'm trying to figure out whether these are the amendments that are in our packet as Exhibit B or these are separate.
I'm not sure what you have with me. I think that they were sent to you. Let's see. Do you have those?
So this is April 21st.
Oh, April, I said April 22nd, but I made April 21st. It was yesterday.
All right. So
I apologize. We don't have a new one today.
All right. So if we could.
thank you.
I want to just get a check on process. Brett, are you also going to be testifying about this, or is Deborah speaking for the
panel?
No,
I'm just here for answering questions.
I'm relying on them to help me answer questions.
Okay, so let's take some council questions, and then we'll move to our next panel. Commissioner Fritz?
So I was expecting you to go into the good neighbor agreement, which this amendment addresses. Are you going to outline what it is and why you want to go that approach?
I can give you an overview if that would help. Yes, I'm Brett Horner. I'm with Portland Parks. I'm the planning manager and actually did a lot of work on the Good Neighbor Agreement. To date, we've done a few Good Neighbor Agreements. They have not all been successful or as successful as we had hoped they would be. And part of the reason for that is it's never been a formalized policy. There's not been real good guidance on how you do one, who has to approve it, who's on the, who is involved in the process. So what we did is we worked on formalizing that process. And in the back of the blue packet, you'll see about a 4-page description of how that Good Neighbor Agreement policy would be implemented. It'd be signed by our director and put into Title 20, which is the Parks and Recreation Code. And the whole purpose of the Good Neighbor Agreement is to provide another tool in cases where there may be some concern with a field improvement, but it doesn't rise to the level of a full conditional use that would involve the Planning Commission and Council. So there are a number of ways one can be initiated. One is the permitting organization, whoever's allowing the use, can decide to do one and just proactively start one and then follow the procedure. Or it can be triggered by the neighborhood if they feel like one needs to be completed. There is a process of getting approval from their one of the neighborhood associations to issue a letter saying we would like a Good Neighbor Agreement to be initiated, and then that would trigger one to happen. It's a fairly detailed policy, and so I don't know how specific you wanted us to get into the actual procedure of it.
Well, I have some significant concerns about the procedure, but maybe we could take testimony on that first to see if others share it. I'm looking at the table on page 10 of the blue packet, which shows which things currently get a Type 3 and would go to a public notice with a Good Neighbor Agreement. And one of them is the issue of that was mentioned at Fernwood with the T-ball to whacking great baseball hits. So how would this Good Neighbor process be any better than what happened at Fernwood?
Well, what we found is that the conditional use process is not necessarily the best tool to resolve a lot of very specific concerns about where trash cans are, where porta potties are put, who cleans the site, what hours of use can be allowed, and that the Good Neighbor Agreement can get a lot more specific. It involves all the parties come to the same table instead of them addressing commissions and councils and that back and forth. So we see it as a much more specific, a much more responsive tool to the neighborhood than a land use process where they have to attend a lot of public meetings, some held in the daytime when they're working. And so we actually feel like it could be a significant improvement.
So did you go through the conditional use process at Fernwood?
We did not, and I believe the Bureau of Development Services determined that it would not require a conditional use, and that's one of the reasons we are proposing these changes today, is that that situation could easily happen again, and we don't want it to happen again, and so we're trying to build in things that would give notice to the neighborhood, give them an opportunity to be involved in some kind of whatever field change or improvement is being made before it gets done.
And how much input have you had from the Office of Neighborhood Involvement and the Neighborhood Associations into the Good Neighbor Agreement?
So we had quite a good set of comments from Brian Hoop of the Office of Neighborhood Involvement. He looked specifically at the Good Neighbor Agreement. We incorporated a few of his changes, or actually all of his changes that he recommended. And then we also worked directly with the Fernwood School neighbors that were so severely impacted by the Little League field that was built, and incorporated some of their changes as well. I believe they're not still as comfortable with the Good Neighbor Agreement as we think or we would like them to be, based on their past history of the Good Neighbor Agreement at that school. But we feel like with the formal policy and there being more clear rules about how to do one, that it will actually work a lot better.
Question? Yeah.
So these amendments do not apply to community colleges and colleges. We've determined that. But what about private schools and charter schools, things like that?
The schools-related amendments would apply to private schools and charter schools as well as all of our school districts.
Okay.
Help me out on the Title 20 would apply to our other school districts as well, public schools, but not private schools.
Correct. Which part's the Title 20?
That's where the Good Neighbor Agreement is.
Oh, okay.
So what I'm going to suggest, and I'm also going to keep an eye on the time, that we hold the amendment for now, go to the next panel. I think we have at least one or two panels, and then come. Pardon me? Excuse me. Commissioner Leonard.
So I've noticed a number of places in the Planning Commission's recommendations where language is added, underlined, and I'll read it to you, and it's replete throughout the report, and I just want you to kind of allay my concern for what the importance of this is. But it says regulations for recreational fields for organized sports. Recreational fields used for organized sports are subject to the regulations of Chapter 33-279, recreational fields for organized sports. That's referenced a number of times through the Planning Commission's recommendations. What does that accomplish by adding that language?
It adds the new section.
Is there a page number that you're looking at?
For an example, 33, but it's throughout the report. It's 35. It's
this here.
Oh, it's adding the new chapter.
Okay. So that's referencing adding the new language Okay. And then I'm looking at what has been represented to me as staff's, Planning Commission staff's, proposed recommendation in terms of the types of reviews that should occur. Are you familiar with this?
I don't know what you're holding up. No.
It is a recommended zoning code language on.
Is there a date? Because we're here today representing the Planning Commission's recommendation.
Don't get ahead of me.
Oh, sorry.
What I'm seeing here is recommended zoning code language that I think the staff initially developed to recommend to the Planning Commission.
Yes.
Are you familiar with that?
The recommendation we brought to Planning Commission before mm-hmm. they made their decision?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You are. Okay. So, and then I'm looking at page 53, which is the table the Planning Commission is recommending, which is the comparison. Do you have your recommendations in front of you?
I think it's the August 19th. Yes, so let me hold that.
It's page 17. And I'm just trying to nuance the difference between the two.
You're referring to this page?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I'm trying to nuance the difference between what the Planning Commission recommended and what you recommended and the upshot.
Okay. The original proposal that staff had put in front of Planning Commission tried to simplify it, but rather than talking about three levels of grades, which currently in the code, elementary, middle school, we said we were looking at the state definition, which says an elementary school is K through 8. So I think we just tried to simplify by saying any change of grade levels within that K through 8 grouping could occur by right, and any change within the high school grade grouping, 9 through 12, could happen by right. But if you moved from one of those levels to the other, that would trigger conditional use. So we had a simpler proposal. But we heard a lot of testimony, and we heard the Planning Commission say that they wanted to have more distinctions because of some of the impacts of introducing younger children into the environment where there are older children and some of those. So that's the distinction.
So am I reaching a fair conclusion when I've read both of these, and I have, when I conclude that the Planning Commission's recommendations requires more type 3 reviews than what the staff recommendation would require?
That would be true.
Okay. Thank you.
I just asked one question on what you just said.
Yes.
I mean, philosophically, I get it when you want to add a high school age population to a 6 to 8 or something like that. But what's the role of the city in looking at issues around the impacts of younger children being exposed to older children when it's a K through 5 to a 6 through 8?
I mean, yeah. Well, you'll be hearing from the really Planning Commission in a moment, but I think that their concern wasn't the social impact of mixing. It was the physical impact of the transportation. If your kids are walking, young kids are walking and the older kids are, taking a different mode, and there's some conflict between the older and the younger kids. I think they were referring specifically to transportation, not some of the other issues, which I would agree with you are not the purview of the city to look at those. But you'll be hearing from the planning commissioners about their thinking. I think they can represent that well.
Other questions from commissioners? Thank you very much. If you can stick around, I'm sure we're going to have some lots of questions. And okay. It's now my pleasure welcome distinguished commissioners from the Planning Commission, Howard Shapiro, Andre Baugh, and Chris Smith. Gentlemen, welcome. We're
not
running
sure
a little
I
late.
Follow
so you,
that.
You each have 30 seconds. Please, you know, take your time. we extend.
And then we can leave in 30 seconds with no questions?
We have a tradition of extending the courtesy to fellow commissioners. Take as much time as you need, but we also have some people signed up, so we want to give everyone a chance to be heard. But welcome, and Howard, why don't you kick us off?
I'll try to be brief. I'm Howard Shapiro, a member of the Portland Planning Commission, soon to add the word sustainability to it. I want to be careful that I'm saying that, because the last time I was before you, I claimed that role, and it hasn't quite happened yet. So we are still the Portland Planning Commission, with some added words coming later. As you probably are aware from the last testimony, we've been at this for quite a while. We've been at this for 18 months, hearing testimony from the schools, from the neighbors, from aggrieved people who over time have felt that they have been not well handled in the whole issue of what the words conditional use mean. And so I'm here today with my fellow colleagues to try to share with you parts of the letter that we sent to you and to articulate why we feel very strongly about mixing ages. And to your question, Commissioner Salzman, it had very much to do with transportation and the impact on the neighborhoods. The commission in December of 2008 agreed to staff proposal to amend the code regulations in the short term, to pursue intergovernmental agreements to provide for collaboration between the city and its school districts in the long term, and to address citywide impacts and opportunities related to decisions about school facilities during the development of the longer-term Portland plan. Let me just stop for a moment and say that the Planning Commission now, as far as I'm concerned, and I think my colleagues would agree, is trying to examine all the work we're doing through the lens of the Portland plan. We're trying to look at it in terms of what we want to incorporate in that document as we put it together for the long pull. And that's critical, important work. And each of these little issues, they're not little, but they're issues, are nuanced in that plan. So that lens is the one we're looking through. The Portland Planning Commission voted unanimously to recommend code amendments for schools and parks because they clarify the conditional use review process and increase flexibility while also providing input for opportunity for public input. The commission has agreed to the changes to conditional use requirements because of the opportunities, pardon me, to work on larger issues during the development of the Portland plan. Commissioners recommend that the Portland plan recognize school districts' jurisdiction over educational policies and planning, but that the city's and the community's mutual interests in collaboration on facilities planning because of the critical relationship between the schools and the community vitality. Recognize the schools as hubs of these 20-minute neighborhoods that we're so focused on, and communities, thereby reducing dependence on auto trips, promoting communal use of facilities, and avoiding unequal impacts on different neighborhoods. Develop agreements between school districts that ensure consistency with the city's goals and policies for transportation connections, reduce dependence on auto travel, equity, enhancement of the 20-minute neighborhoods, and overall livability. Encourage good neighbor agreements to intergovernmental agreements and other non-regulatory tools to provide for better relationship between schools, parks, and the public, but tie any lapses to conditional use criteria that ensure the city has the teeth to enforce that compliance. And finally, to encourage opportunities for public input, blending of jurisdictional boundaries, and community-wide discussions in developing intergovernmental agreements with school districts and making decisions on facilities. Before I conclude my testimony and turn this over to other commissioners, I want to quote from a letter that we received from Superintendent Smith. She feels very strongly in the opposite of what we've developed, and we understand that and respect it. But in one of her paragraphs, and I'm quoting her now, and it may be out of context, but I think it's relevant, she says, and I quote, "It's unfortunate the code refinement project to date has not clearly articulated the distinction between public school programming, which is the sole responsibility of the public school districts, and the City of Portland's land use role and zoning code authority in regulating impacts from the schools on surrounding neighborhoods. This distinction should be made," end quote. So I'd like to end my testimony by saying you need to deliberate the viability of what we put before you. We took a more stringent position than the staff required because of transportation issues and what we thought were safety issues. And in my own personal opinion, the intermingling of these ages when we begin to move ages of children together in a community. But overriding all of this, I personally, and I believe my colleagues will agree, want to come before you with one overriding request, and that is that we do develop an intergovernmental relationship between the schools, the parks, and the city as we go forward and develop the Portland plan. These boundaries are artificial. School boundaries, park boundaries, city boundaries, they don't exist. We are one contiguous stream, and we need an intergovernmental agreement that provides for the kind of conversation that makes us coexist together. So I thank you, and I turn it over to now more articulate people.
Commissioner Shapiro, I just have a question. I'm going to make sure I'm tracking all of this. Your commission recommendations to us were unanimous in each of the four categories. Is that correct?
There was a vote of 4-1, so there was a dissenting vote.
Okay. In terms of the letter you've just referenced from from Carol Smith from Portland Public Schools.
Yes.
Is it fair to say that the issue she's raising goes to change of grade, not to either recreational fields, enrollment, or length of vacancy?
That's my understanding.
The four issues before us, her letter addresses one where there is some disagreement.
She's very protective of her position and the school's position. I understand that. That's pretty much what the letter says.
Thank you.
She should speak for herself. That's how I read the letter.
I wanted to focus on which of the four issues that there is a disagreement.
Fair enough. So, Commissioner Baugh.
Andre Baugh, Portland Planning Commissioner. I want to talk a little bit about build on what Howard said about the Portland Plan and talk about what I think is the focus. Today, as we did as planning commissioners, you'll hear a lot of things about policy, school policy, equity, in those issues. But where I think our focus was as a planning commissioner was talking about transportation. And when you change that neighborhood in terms of a school and a grade, especially at the lower grades, people move their kids, whether right or wrong, in cars. And the moms pick them up and drop them off. And if you're moving across the neighborhood, we as a Portland plan are focusing on building these tighter neighborhoods that address climate change, that address transportation issues, that address goods and services closer to each of those individuals. And when we have a part of that fabric, a integral part of that fabric, the education system, wanting to make a change to that, I think we should offer the public, the neighborhood, the people that we've asked to live in these close neighborhoods 25 years from now, to have a part of that decision. And really what we're saying is, I think as a commission, to have a discussion about what that change is transportation-wise, not about policy, not about the equity of it, but about the transportation issue, because we have a climate change that you've endorsed policy. We have a transportation plan that you've endorsed, and we ought to understand the connectivity, how that impacts those plans because they're not plans in isolation. They're plans that have to work together, or kind of the system breaks down if they all work in isolation. And so I would encourage you to take a look at the broader perspective of how all of these plans, and this being really a kind of a tip of the iceberg, are going to work together to achieve that broader goal. Yes, this is very specific today that you're focused on, and it is just one part of that, but it gets to how it's going to work ultimately. Are we going to have that conversation? And I would build on Howard's observation of this IGA, this cooperation amongst schools, not disagreeing with Ms. Smith's argument that she needs to be protective of what the role of the school is. I think we need to be protective of what is our role as a city and how do we work together to achieve both and do that in a cooperative manner.
So if I could ask a question about what you said, Mr. Bond, anybody can answer it. Mm-hmm. Did you, in your deliberations, did you consider what I feel as though we have to consider, and that is the broader picture of how a city functions and delivers services, including educational opportunities and services to children, in the context of certainly in the best of all worlds, your goal and the stated goal of the recommendations in the Planning Commission make a lot of sense, but in the real world that we're living in, Measure 5 passed in 1990, severely constricting the resources for the public schools, shifting that responsibility to the legislature. The legislature has consistently been unable to fully fund education because of lack of resources. So the school district in Portland, the case in point, is left with trying to figure out what to do with the resources they have and how to best and most efficiently maximize their facilities to get the most bang for the dollar. And it would appear that because some in the community don't agree with the strategy the district has developed, they're now trying to develop a strategy through the code in order to further hobble the district from putting together plans that would maximize their resources so that it gets to the end of the day that is a object of futility for the school district to attempt to try to do what they're charged to do, and that is to provide the best educational opportunities possible.
Yeah. You're talking about a cost issue.
You're talking about cost issue or?
Talking about process issue, cost issues, making decisions, what it is that's required to make a decision to ultimately get something done to deliver educational opportunities to kids, and finding the balance between what is in the community's best interest, what's in the kids' best interest, and what can the school district do with the resources they have. And it would appear that we're in the process of adding one more weight around their neck in terms of giving them the latitude they need to do what they have to do. So I throw that out there because that's the white elephant in the room here that overshadows this discussion. And again, you know, I'm looking at the 102 code complaints that were filed when Fernwood School wanted to do what they wanted to do to have Little League. I'm not sure people were so focused on there being a code violation as they were not wanting to have Little League baseball next to their houses, and the code was used as an attempt to stop that. This feels like it may be related to that somehow. And you know, I just wonder if you would address that.
Go ahead. You want to do it, Howard? Or I'll take a shot.
I'm not sure what your question is, but don't...
Are we being used to achieve some other end other than achieving climate goals?
I would say no. In a part of that discussion is a policy discussion, and I agree with you, and I think the Portland Public Schools has an interest with, as Howard said, in managing your school district, and that every school district in Portland has that interest, and that should be their interest. The other part of that is Howard mentioned about the IGA, and I think this is where the fuzzy comes in. We have an interest in the transportation component of that school district, of how those children move. However, there is a overriding interest, I think, of education. And how does that work? It's really fuzzy right now. We have something in front of us today that is, to my view, very strictly and narrowly focused on transportation, about children moving between grades and moving through a neighborhood. But there is, to your point, a broader policy issue of how that education system, in a global sense, and I think that's part of your responsibility to look at that, how it works with the city of Portland and these future neighborhoods that we're trying to put together. We didn't really honestly address that because we looked at the code, but part of the Portland plan has to address that issue, because that's the other box that was shaded out, is the policy of how the education system and a number of other systems are going to work in the city of Portland long term.
Could I, Commissioner, follow up on that for a sec? Oh, Commissioner Friends.
Well, I was just wondering, isn't that why you're recommending it to be a Type 3 rather than a Type 2, so that an appeal would come to City Council, so that there would be able to be those policy discussions?
Yes. There'd be an open discussion. There'd be an open discussion with the city as well.
Clearly.
Yes. Yes, but I want to circle back another way, Commissioner Leonard, because I think you ask a provocative question, and I'm just as troubled as you are about expending school resources for things that seem unnecessary or burdensome, regulatory speaking. And that is that when we look through the lens of the Portland plan, the schools are integral to the 20-minute neighborhood. I want to say that there's nothing more important, in my view, when we build 20-minute neighborhoods, that there be a school, a vital school within that community, serving public education to the highest level. So we certainly support that. But we also support the notion that the schools have a responsibility outside their internal governance of reaching out and being part of a neighborhood. And I think that's where we're concerned about keeping this Type 3 in place, so that the neighborhood, in fact, has some public access to how it's being changed when children's ages, transportation, all these things weigh. It's a difficult thing to balance. I'm not saying that we are hard one way or the other. What I'm saying, not to be redundant, is we need intergovernmental cooperation and dialogue about what our mutual goals are, which are building good community.
And I've been here nearly 8 years and have sat on more quasi-judicial hearings than I want to. And it would be disingenuous of me to tell you that they are impartial, neutral hearings. They are highly political. They are highly charged. They are oftentimes organized around citizen groups threatening to organize opponents against you in the next election if you don't vote their way on a given project or against a given project. So I have to say that when I see that you're recommending a Type 3 review for citizen input, I'm a little suspect, because that feels to me more like you're trying to create an environment in which some of these decisions are answered politically rather than through the staff who does come at these issues, in my experience, very methodically, very objectively. And I'm just a little concerned about politicizing the school system any more than what it has already been by people with good intentions.
At the risk of agreeing with you, because I sit in planning commission hearings and see the same kind of organization.
No, you do.
I do believe in democracy, and I do believe that citizens should and must have a right to speak. Unfortunately, they found a way to organize that can be very difficult from time to time.
Let's not forget the school board's elected.
That's true. And we totally support and agree with that. Absolutely.
So, Howard, can I, by the way, I've had the honor of serving with Howard on another body once, and at the moment in the debate where he says that's a provocative question, I know we've actually reached the moment of truth. That is a Howard-ism that will be, you know, writ large someday. So I appreciate, Howard, what you said about the struggle for the balance, because that's what we're trying to do. We're looking for that balance. You have thoughtfully slugged through this and given us a recommendation. Staff gave you a recommendation that had a slightly different way of looking at the balance. Our job is to respect all these views and try to come up with the right balance. So I appreciate your comment. And I have just two questions for anyone who would like to answer. The first is, as a dad who picks up his kids.
They're cute kids.
I just want to say that you know, I have a kindergartner and a junior in high school. And I'm trying to understand why we draw a distinction between K-5 and middle school coming together versus treating K-8 as a unit and then doing our grids. And I guess I don't understand. It sort of builds on what Commissioner Saltzman asked. I'm not sure I understand that distinction. I think I do understand why if you take a high school setting and merge it with a K-8, that should trigger a higher level of review. I guess I'm not as clear as to why within